Morning, sir.
Morning. I was sitting in the public library in Sermon Street just now, skimming through Rogue Harry's by Horace Walpole, when I suddenly came over all peckish.
Peckish, eh?
Esurient.
Eh?
Yabberall, oldie-like.
Ah, hungry.
In a nutshell, so I thought to myself, a little fermented curd will do the trick. So I curtailed my wall-polling activities, sallied forth and infiltrated your place of purveyance to negotiate the bending of some cheesy comestibles.
Come again?
I want to buy some cheese!
Ah! I thought you were complaining about the music.
Oh, heaven forbid, I'm one who delights in all manifestations of the Terpsichorean muse.
Sorry?
I like a nice dance, you forced to.
Anyway,
who said that?
Oh, my good man, some cheese, please.
Yes, certainly, sir. What would you like?
Well, how about a little...
Press of progress.
I'm afraid we're fresh out of...
Press of progress, sir.
Never mind. How are you on...
Insurrection.
Never at the end of the week, sir. Always get it fresh first thing on Monday.
Tish, tish. No matter. Well, 4 ounces of...
Tendrils of agony.
If you please, stout yeoman.
Ah, well, it's been on order for 2 weeks, sir. I was expecting it this morning.
Yes, it's not my day, is it?
Embercleave?
Sorry.
Crater of Behemoth?
Normally, sir, yes. But today the van broke down.
Ah.
How about any threat in effect at all?
No.
You do have some cheese, do you?
Oh, certainly, sir. It's a cheese shop, sir. We've got...
No, don't tell me. I'm keen to guess.
Fair enough.
How about some brain freeze?
Not today, sir, no.
Well, let's keep it simple. How about...
Lightning bolt?
Well, I'm afraid we don't get much call for it around these parts, sir.
Much call? It's the single most popular cheese in the world.
Not around these parts, sir.
And pray, what is the most popular cheese round these parts?
Mill.
I see.
Yes, sir, it's quite staggeringly popular in the manor, squire.
Is it?
Yes, sir, it's our number one seller.
Is it?
Yes, sir.
Milling your opponent out.
Right.
Okay, I'm game. Have you got any, he asked, expecting the answer no.
I'll have a look, sir. No.
It's not much of a cheese shop, really, is it?
Mine is in the district, sir.
And what leads you to that conclusion?
Well, it's so clean.
Well, it's certainly uncontaminated by cheese.
You haven't asked me about...
Fosse's Oracle.
Sir?
Is it worth it?
Could be.
Okay. Have you...
Will you shut that bloody dancing up?
I told you so.
Have you got any...
Thassa's Oracle.
No,
that figures. No, it's pretty predictable, really. It was an act of pure optimism to pose the question in the first place. Tell me something. Do you have any cheese at all?
Yes, sir.
Now, I'm going to ask you that question once more. And if you say no, I'm going to shoot you through the head. Now, do you have any cheese at all?
No.
What a senseless waste of human life.
Does it make sense to end with that?
Yeah, we should talk
start
about
some more magic stuff first. Yeah. Just as an intro. All right, great. Well, in that case, hello, listeners. Welcome. Come in. Make yourselves at home in this brand new episode of Lucky Paper Radio. My name is Andy, and I'm here, as always, with my co-host, Anthony. Wait, I had one, and now it's gone.
It's a great start.
Wait, what was it?
Take your time. Relax. Calm down.
Oh, yeah. You're the guy that spilled oil over his kitchen Maddox. It was very funny. It wasn't even that hard to clean up. You have to admit it was just pretty funny.
It wasn't as hard to clean up as I had envisioned every time I have envisioned this horrible thing happening to me.
The psychic damage you incurred was far greater than any actual damage that was done to the kitchen or anything in there.
Everything's fine. I'm a few towels lighter.
You have a deep fryer.
Yes.
It's got a drain. So you can drain the
for
oil out of the deep...
easy cleaning. It's labeled
cleaning.
Right on the front. Easy clean.
That way you don't have to tip your whole deep fryer upside down to get the oil out.
Great feature.
Which would be super annoying. We were doing some cooking at your house, and you encouraged Hillary to pour the oil into the thing.
That is a fun wrinkle, yeah.
You encouraged Hillary to pour the oil into the deep fryer.
She asked but if she could help, and I said, here's the next thing that has to happen.
But Hillary, my dear wife, whom I love, tends to be a little clumsy in the kitchen, and she was like, I don't want to be responsible for hoisting
some
this
dents in some 2 gallon. Of my appliances already.
She did not want to be responsible for hoisting a 2 gallon container of oil into the air and pouring it into this thing. She said, no, I don't want to do it. I'll make a mess, implying she would like spill a little as she poured it in. And then you poured the whole thing in, and only upon getting it all in there. And I peeked over and noticed that it wasn't as full as I expected.
I was also noticing there were two things that gave it away. It was the fact that it wasn't filling as fast as I expected, which is kind of alarming, and the sound of dripping oil. Because, as you've probably figured out, the valve was open. And also, for further context, every time I've used the deep fryer, and I think you can attest to this, I've said verbally, like, better check this valve. That would be a horrible thing if I left this open.
You are very fastidious in all things in life. Uh-huh. And, you know, are very keen to measure twice and cut once, as it were.
Yes. And so, I was very afraid of this happening every time I've used the deep fryer. Like, sure, people might be afraid of fire and explosions and splatter. I'm just afraid of leaving this valve open and being a dummy. And finally happened.
Your worst fear has come true and wasn't even that bad.
It wasn't even that bad.
This is definitely one of those times, and I have these things too, where the psychic damage is so much worse than the actual damage, right? Like, a person who was much more chaotic than you would have just done it, made a mess, cleaned it up, but they wouldn't have worried about it every other time pouring it into the deep fryer.
The fact that I have worried about it every time I've used it.
Right, so like you have definitely taken more stress than somebody else who would have just made a big mess and cleaned it up, but you worried about it every time you did it before, mm-hmm. and then it happened, and when it happened, you were like, oh no, it's D-Day. It's the thing I've worried about forever. It's finally happened. But it was actually not that bad.
Yeah. I just thought it was funny because it says right there, easy cleanup, and it is easy cleanup most of the time, and then it comes with one more difficult cleanup eventually when you forget to close the valve. Anyway, now there's a little sticker on the front that says, don't forget me.
Three easy payments of $19.99 and one very difficult payment. Anyway, tonight's episode actually is a little bit about deep frying. We have a little dual topic for you, two small topics lined up. First, I want to talk about something directly magic related, then you have something maybe magic adjacent to talk about.
Magic adjacent.
Let's talk about magic first, as this is ostensibly a magic podcast. In the most recent draft of my Bun Magic Cube, I had this like blue-red, I would call it like a turbo prowess deck. It was like a blue-red spellslinger deck, but I had none of the token generators. I had no Third Path Iconoclast or Young Pyromancer, and I also had no counterspells. Maybe one. I had exactly Force of Will, I think. Yeah, I did.
Force of Will is a cool one counterspell to have, to be honest.
It is. It definitely is, because then you never have to...
It's not like you're trying to keep up mana only right. on certain turns.
So I had exactly one Force of Will. I was definitely not like a reactive deck. It was a full-on dedicated aggro deck that was using prowess synergies. I had both baubles and two prowess one drops and all these other cheap and free spells. And the way this deck happened to win a lot of its matches in games was I had a fair number of flash flyers in the deck. I had Fairy Mastermind, Brazen Barber, Vendilion Click, maybe one more. Those are the main three. And I also had Death Greeter Champion, which is a card we talked about on the Phyrexia All-Be-One Commander product or March of the Machine Commander product. One of the two. I can't remember which.
I believe it's March of the Machine Commander.
That's the one that has backup, right?
Yes.
Yeah, whatever set has backup, that Commander product has this card, Death Greeter Champion, which I gotta say, I talked about it in our Personal Cube Editions episode, and I have been really impressed with this card. It is a 2 and a red for a 2-1 with double strike and backup 1, and also dash for 3 and a red. So you can either just play it as a 3 mana 2-1 double strike backup 1, and the backup again is put a +1/+1 counter on a creature, and it gains all other abilities of this creature's end of turn, in this case, just double strike. And the way I won so many games with this deck, Anthony, was just I would pass, I would be maybe behind on board, or my opponent would think they had like stabilized and turned the corner. Then I would flash in a 3-power flyer on my opponent's end step, and I would untap, and I would dash in Death Greeter Champion, put a +1/+1 counter on Vendilion Click, hit them for 8 in the air, plus an additional 4 on the ground, in addition to whatever I already had on board, right? Like 12 additional power with haste on turn 4, or on 4 mana, basically.
Yeah, I mean, and this is a context where, like, the fact that your cube has a ton of damage, a ton of life loss from lands, like, the fact that everybody starts the game at, like, 14 because of playing all the shock lands and fetch lands, that really matters in matchups like this.
Yeah, it was a really splashy way to close things out, and I honestly think that if we were to play a bunch of matches with those decks, I think my opponents should start to play around that exact sequence.
Sure.
A flash flyer into Death Greeter's Champion, and that should inform their sequencing and inform the answers they hold up and how they curve out and everything. But my opponents didn't see it coming because we only played one or two games and it just got them. Which got me thinking, Anthony. I would say in some cases I was just kind of already ahead and that's how I closed out the game. In some cases, though, I definitely had fallen behind. My opponent had stabilized and I was able to win from behind by just kind of playing this line, right? I put a evasive creature into play and then made it way bigger than it had any right to be for one attack and in that way won a game. I sometimes use the term cheese to describe winning a game from behind. Like I cheesed a game from my opponent. I see other people using this terminology as well.
We're not super heavy on a lot of the magic lingo here because we want to be accessible and clear and not confusing. But this is definitely a thing that comes up a lot where people are like, oh, you know, I was ahead. I had stabilized and then he just cheesed me out with a Banefire.
Another word you could use here is just stole the game, right? Like I stole a game that otherwise I had no right to win. And I don't think this terminology is specific to Magic. I think it's a thing that's about all games. And the comparison I want to draw here is actually to the other game I love in my life, which is Super Smash Brothers. So Super Smash Brothers is a platform fighter. This is like the most popular game on the planet. So I don't think I have to explain it to anybody, but for the purposes of this argument, I will explain it.
It's a video game.
It's a video game, and it is unique among fighting games, or rather it was the first of a new genre of fighting game where you defeated your opponent not by reducing their life bar to zero, but by instead essentially wringing them out. In the case of Super Smash Bros., you are knocking them off a stage so they fall to their death or are blasted so far off the side or top of the stage that they can't return.
It's like sumo wrestling. You're trying to exhaust your opponent so you can more easily force them off the ring.
Right. So every time you hit them, they take damage, and the damage increases their percent, and the higher their percent is, the further they get hit back by every subsequent blow. But you could live to 1,000%. 999% is the max percentage you can live to in Super Smash Bros. It doesn't go any higher than that.
Really? So it's just like the Zoanite in Tears of the Kingdom. That's a callback to earlier in your kitchen.
It's exactly like that. The percentage, I don't think, has a like literal translation, but effectively, around 100%, you should expect to die to a lot of moves, right? So you can go to 10 times past the point where like you kind of should be dead, more or less, and theoretically still be alive. The inverse of that, of course, is that you can also die at zero, right? You can end up off stage and your opponent could just hit you with one little attack, just placed just so, so that you can't get back to the stage. And even though you had your full life bar effectively, you just die.
You can just walk off the edge and forget which button is the jump button and just lose.
You can also do that. And I don't actually play other fighting games, but my understanding is that other fighting games, you have a life bar and it's reduced. And I think it's still very much possible to come back in those fighting games, but I think the texture of a comeback is probably very different. Because once you're at a really low life total, you're just going to die to any hit. I imagine you have to play way differently. And you do have to play differently in Super Smash Bros. When you're at a higher percent, but I think there's mechanically, fundamentally, in the way the game is designed, more of an opportunity for comebacks, because you can literally kill people at almost no percent if you play your cards right.
I mean, and similarly, if you're at a very low life total or like a high damage in Super Smash Bros., you can hold on. Like there is this swingy nature where it's not just like, yeah, I'm dead to any one hit. You can play in different ways to try and stabilize even when you're in a difficult spot.
There are other mechanics in the game too that are more subtle. So the more damage you have on your character, the more damage your moves actually do. It's called rage. So your moves do a little less knockback and a little less damage when you're at zero. And when you're at 100, they do more. So you actually have a little bit of a comeback mechanic, even on top of the fact that they have to actually kill you, right? They can't just keep hitting you with some little dinky move that doesn't have any knockback and win the game that way. They have to eventually actually knock you off stage to get you dead. I think this is a brilliant aspect of the design of Super Smash Bros. I think it makes the game so much more dynamic and exciting, and I think it's chiefly responsible for why it's such a successful fighting game franchise that has spawned a whole category of games, platform fighters, where you're really not playing this game of just combos and life totals, but instead spacing and placement on the stage and strategy and all these other sort of elements come into play. But I think part of what makes that a great game design decision is because of the comeback potential, because you can cheese people, and that makes for just much more exciting games, I think. Normally, when I talk about getting cheesed out in Magic, it's a criticism of the game.
You don't sound positive about this most of the time.
Yes, if I get cheesed out, I generally am not happy about it. I'm honestly not happy to win if I cheese my opponent out either.
It's like, yeah, you couldn't see that coming. There wasn't like an opportunity for interesting interaction. It's just like, I just had this. I just had three burn spells in my hand.
And in one case, like, sure, maybe there's a little bit of satisfaction if I did draft the deck with the Flash Flyers and the Death Reader's Champion and like put that synergy together. But also sometimes you just like have another burn spell and your opponent stabilizes at three and they're like, I hope you don't draw your lightning bolt. And you're like, oops, I did. Even though you're way ahead on board and I'm dead in two turns, I just happen to draw this card that ends the game, even though I've effectively lost, right? And that's the tension that I want to like capture here, is that there are all these abstract ways to look at a game of Magic. Resources, board presence, tempo, all these sort of things we talk about, card advantage. And these are these abstractions that you're kind of navigating. And these, to me, are like the percent bar in Super Smash Brothers, right? Like, every time you get your opponent a little 2-for-1, their percentage goes up or whatever. But just like Super Smash Brothers, you can get all the card advantage and all of the tempo and all of the board presence you want. You can still die to getting cheesed out if you don't have the right answers at the right moments for your opponent's one sort of sneaky play. So normally, I don't like this. And I would say normally, I make decisions about the design of my cube to try and limit the number of games that are ended by a game being stolen or a game being cheesed out, as it were. But I've been wondering how much that is actually like logically consistent, because I do like that kind of interaction in something like Super Smash Brothers. So to turn it over to you, Anthony, what do you think about having cards in a cube that allow for wins from behind? I don't mean cards that just like stabilize, right? Like, I asked a question on Twitter, what are cards that allow you to win while behind? And a lot of the answers, reasonably so, of course, were like board wipes, balance, stuff that like, you know, gets you back from being behind. But that's not what I mean. I mean, like, the game ends with you, by all measures except life total, behind, but you just managed to win from behind. How do you feel about games that end that way and cards that lead to those sorts of games?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree that there is a tension here, which is interesting and I don't quite have a handle on, where I think that comeback mechanics that are good from behind are absolutely critical to interesting game design.
Right.
A lot of games, especially resource management games, they're really just whoever is ahead is much more advantaged to get more ahead. I mean, think...
because resources are good, yeah, so they snowball.
The resources let you get more resources. I mean, think things like Monopoly, or like a more sort of simple example, a game like Splendor, which is like really fun the first couple times you play it, but then once you realize it's just like, oh yeah, I just sort of follow this pathway and I accumulate resources to accumulate more resources, there isn't really back and forth. There's not really a lot of interaction between players, because it really just becomes about who's playing that optimized resource game better. And that's really not that fun to me. But if you have these catch-up mechanics that actually benefit you from playing to a certain situation, I mean, I think Wraths are a great example of this, because they benefit you for making a short-term loss and getting a longer-term gain by your opponent overextending. Like, that is a really fundamental, interesting challenge and sort of tension to the game that makes games meaningful and not just about who's playing that resource game most optimally. And this sort of like stealing a game feels like it is on that same spectrum, but it's not just about stabilizing and coming back from behind. It's about extending from the back of the field, and I'm sure there's a sports term for shooting the basket from the wrong side of the court.
I'm not sure there is, actually. I'm not a huge sports fan, but I know more about it than you do, and I'm not sure there is a term for that.
Okay, well, they should do that more often. It sounds fun. Why don't they simply kick the baseball all the way across the field?
I guess what you're referring to is just doing an onside kick every time?
Sure.
I don't know.
So, I don't know. It feels... I think maybe that's where it feels different to me, is it's always just a matter of expectations. Because if you are in that situation where it's like, I know my opponent has Lightning Bolt in their deck, I'm going to play around, like, my best line is, how do I kill them as quickly as possible to, like, reduce the number of draws? There's interesting tension there when you have expectations, so your whole strategy is still built around trying to optimize for that win percentage, even though you know some percentage of the time you're going to have that game stolen by, they just get lucky and draw that one card. So,
and if it's something you expect and you are playing the entire game with the expectation that, like, I don't want to get to three, mm-hmm, that's different than using your life total as a resource and not knowing your opponent has Lightning Bolt in their deck and making strategic decisions to say, I'm going to take this damage because it instead gives me a better clock, but then you take the damage and it actually means you lost the game because your opponent has Lightning Bolt in their hand.
Right. I mean, maybe the other way to think about it is, I don't love that experience when it's just, oh, you just had a card I didn't know about and it invalidated my choices. That's what can be really frustrating. Like,
yes,
I didn't realize there was a Banefire in this cube. I'm going to use that example because I saw this happen to someone
yesterday. There was a lot of Banefire happening last night, and it was, I don't think, great games for most people.
Well, but I think that's the key, is if you don't see it coming, it's really frustrating. It's just like, oh, like, why did I make all these choices? Why did I spend this time playing this game when I didn't know that could happen?
Well, this was a team draft, so in subsequent matches, people did know it was coming. They did communicate about it, and it still wasn't fun, even with expectations set.
All right, well, let's say if you're zooming out and you're saying, I know I'm going to play against this particular deck that has the Banefire a dozen times, you're no longer playing to win this one game and all your decisions are invalidated if you lose that one game. all of your decisions are still meaningful because you're saying, I'm trying to optimize my win percentage in these dozen matches, and I know some percentage of these games I'm just going to lose. Like, these decisions won't matter in that micro scale of that one game, but those decisions still matter in the context of 12 games, because if you didn't make them, you would have lost all 12 games, right?
Right.
Does that make any sense? Where it's like,
it's
about setting expectations and still having an opportunity to win on us on the scale that is bigger and meaningful. And when it's just, this is the singular experience, you got cheesed out, that's really frustrating.
Yeah. And I agree that all these cards we're talking about are in the category of cards that are, like, good when you're behind. But there's a big difference, I think, between cards that are good when you're behind in the sense that they still navigate those abstract parts of the game, right? Like, a board wipe is good when you're behind because it represents a lot of potential card advantage and completely eliminating your opponent's board presence. And those are the kind of abstract, like, it gets you back to parity. You're no longer behind after it resolves.
Right.
A lot of these things I'm talking about don't touch any of those at all. It just says, yeah, I'll stay behind. Don't care. I'm just going to kill my opponent.
Yeah, that's a good point, is that, like, if you are just behind, if you just played the cards you mentioned, what did you mention? Vendilion Click or...
Vendilion Click and Brazen Borrower and yeah, Death
Breeder's
Champion.
You flash in your Brazen Borrower. You can't just use that one card necessarily to incrementally catch up. You know, if you block a 2-2 with that, and then your opponent still has a couple creatures in play, you're potentially still losing that game. And same with Deathgrader Champion, it, as a blocker, is not great. So the fact that you're doing something different, not just by trying to incrementally come back from behind, but actually just overextend beyond whatever your opponent was doing and kill them in one shot and sort of, you know, make all their resources not matter by making them not in the game anymore.
And I do think a lot of these examples are going to come down to effectively some sort of burn, because that's the one resource you can attack that isn't governed by these other abstractions we're talking about. Like,
I mean, we could definitely throw Mill in there as well, but that doesn't
that
come
is
up
true.
As often
that
in,
is definitely
in the kind
true.
Of magic we play.
The other examples that came up that I think make a lot of sense, Mill can definitely be that way, especially
Which,
in some cubes.
I mean, that's hilarious to think about. Like, you would never think of Mill as a catch-up mechanic, but it is a way that you can win a game when you're behind.
You can be so far behind and then just Mill your opponent out. I mean, I had a match at KubeCon last year. It was my first match I ever played against Zach Hill. I was, you know, mildly starstruck to be playing against him. My whole game plan against this deck was to mill him out with Stroke of Genius. I was playing like a blue-red control deck, and my win condition was basically, well, it was Form of the Dragon, and if Form of the Dragon didn't work, then it was Stroke of Genius to kill him. And he had this Abzan mid-range deck that had a ton of value and just was always ahead on board. Like, I couldn't compete on board. I had to win either by resolving this enchantment and hoping he had no answers for it, because in the Abzan deck, you don't have very many flyers, and Form of the Dragon just completely hard locks out decks without flyers, essentially. Or I needed to just get to the late game and then Stroke of Genius him. And I remember a game where I was so far behind the entire time and got to the last turn, and I could make him draw his entire library save for one card, and then he could untap, draw that card, and kill me. And it's like, yeah, I got really close to just stealing that game with Mill that I otherwise had no right to win, just because I was only focusing on that one resource, those cards in library. So burn, Mill, I think, is that way. I think another form this can take sometimes is threaten effects. I think
for
threaten
sure.
effects can be really swingy.
I mean, that's also another great example where they don't catch you up incrementally.
No,
really. Like, you do a little bit of extra damage.
Threaten effects
are... you can combine them with sacrifice and stuff. There are ways you can do it, but on their face, it's just like, I'm going to do a bunch of extra damage to you.
Yeah, and you're just trading a card for damage. So, I mean, it's still kind of a burn spell, basically,
true,
a threaten
yeah,
effect,
yeah.
right? Like, if you fast forward a turn, you don't have any more resources than you had before you cast the threat, and all you did was either force a block that your opponent didn't want to make, or you reduce their life total more. Again, not barring synergies with sack outlets or whatnot. There was another, just to keep the anecdotes coming of games that were cheesed out. This I don't even think this counts as cheesed out because it was in such early stages of the game, but we did a Dominaria draft somewhat recently, which we rarely do non-cube drafts. We did a Dominaria draft, though. My opponent had the Saga Chainer's Torment, which I believe the chapters are the first two, it drains you for two, and then the last one, it halves the controller's life total. It makes a token the size of their life total. My opponent did this, and then they had one other creature in play, and on the end step, I removed their other creature, and then I untapped and played the red kicker creature that has a threatened effect on kicker, and I just stole his creature that was the size of his life total.
Nice.
And it's like, limited, Matt, you could have been at 900. It doesn't matter. Like, your life total was irrelevant. This threatened effect just wins the game outright in this exact situation. So anyway, we described it in more detail, but like, how do you actually feel about these kinds of cards and game endings? Like, I think there's two reads of it, right? One read is what I think I am more naturally inclined to, which is to say that the interesting aspect of the game is navigating the resource management, all the resources, the board presence, the tempo, all that kind of stuff, mana usage, and any cards or strategies that essentially cut against that and say you can completely obviate choices made about those other resources and just end the game in one fell swoop, I think I'm inclined to say are not my favorite. But to go back to like the Smash example, I think the other argument to be made here is that they add a lot of excitement and dynamicism to the game and say that even if you do fall behind, you still have live draws. You still have outs, right?
Yes.
Like, if you fall behind in like a mid-range mirror and you don't have board wipes in your deck, you either need to have cards kind of like this that are like big swings of advantage or can potentially cheese your opponent out, or you just probably can't come back and you're just going to lose this kind of long, grindy game, generally speaking, right? Like, we've all been in those games where you're behind and you're like, well, if I draw runner, 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 the best cards in my deck, and my opponent draws runner, 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 land, I have a chance. And so I'm not supposed to concede, but feels really bad, right? And those are the kind of games that I think having these elements in a cube or in your deck really change, I think, the mentality and the attitude of like looking at those top decks. Because if you're looking for that threat and effect to just kill your opponent, that can be exciting and fun. Where do you land?
Yeah, I mean, I think that where I land, and I'm feeling more confident in this now, is that even though those might be some unfun moments, the net fun that is added by some of these experiences is positive. And I don't think that is a paradox, even though it sounds like they're at odds. There's a metaphor that I want to make all the time. We're just going really deep on metaphors this episode. I wish I had a better metaphor for this thing, but the thing is sickle cell anemia. How much do you know about sickle cell anemia?
Basically nothing. Okay, I know there are billboards for it around sometimes.
You know that you have two of most of your chromosomes?
I hope.
I hope so as well. There are two of them. And if you have one of these genes has this particular
mutation or whatever.
This particular whatever. You have a particular form of the gene. You actually have a resistance to malaria. It's actually a very strong advantage to you to have exactly one of these in your two copies of a particular gene. If you have both, you get sickle cell, and it's not a great condition for you, so it's a negative. And that's a weird thing to think about evolution.
So it's just like homeopathy. A little bit of the bad thing is actually good.
Actually, I'm going to stop you right there. It's actually not like that at all. At all. But it is, again, this kind of like, it feels like it's a contradiction where having one of these genes is a positive, but having both of them is a negative, but it still is to the population, and of course evolution happens on populations, not on individuals, it is still a positive adaptation, even though it causes some challenges. And I feel like this is similar, where the population of the games is benefit by having some of these difficult moments and like these extreme swingy moments that add overall fun. They add meaningfulness when you are thinking, I still have an out in this game, even though I'm pretty far behind. And you can't really do that without introducing some moments that are less fun. How do you feel about that?
That is a really complicated way to basically say, like, you could have too much of a good thing.
No, I don't think it's that. I think it's something different. Like, I think it is something that the sometimes
a population can have too much of a
negative
good thing.
Is necessary for the population to be successful in some cases. I would love if somebody actually can give me a better metaphor than sickle cell for explaining that kind of situation. I would love that.
It's definitely not concise, but
it's not concise.
But reach out to us. Mail at luckypaper.co.
I mean, there's
got to
be a better example in the natural world that people would actually be familiar with that explains that.
Yeah, like having one dessert is nice and having four desserts is really bad for you.
But it's not the same thing.
Sounds pretty similar.
Okay, then
anyway.
Then I'm not explaining my metaphor well, which is on me.
No, I think I get what you're saying. And also,
if I'm getting the biology way wrong, you can
don't write
that.
In about that.
No.
You
can write in
just
about
Google
that.
That and don't listen to us. We're not doctors. This is not medical advice. No, I think I hear what you're saying. And also, I think, honestly, for most people, I think a lot of people wouldn't describe these moments as bad, right? Like, these are the kind of story moments that I think a lot of people actually have in mind specifically when they design their cubes. And you and I play way more cube than the average person, and we draft the same cube many, many times over. And I think these are the kinds of things that maybe are a fun novelty when you're first designing a cube and you want these kinds of moments. And then the more you replay it and the more that same moment happens over and over again, then you're actually like, okay, this is actually kind of not what I want because it becomes all about that. But I think, honestly, to some people, the things we're describing, you know, using your threaten to steal your opponent's creature that's the size of their life total, or top decking that burn spell, or combining a flash flyer with a dash double strike plus one counter creature, like, these might be the kinds of things people are into cube for. And so I don't want to take for granted that it's like a accepted bad play pattern, broadly speaking. And I do think that a lot of the benefit can be invisible, right? Like, the benefit of, like, you feeling better about going into this, like, the late game a little bit behind in some match because you know that you have these outs in your deck, like, that's not the kind of thing you're going to get a ton of feedback about from your players. You're not going to see that in the games, right?
That's such a great point, yeah.
You're not going to see the, like, the hope in someone's eyes when they know they have these live
Unless
outs.
You look very carefully.
When they know they have these live outs that not just, like, recoup some card advantage and make the game slightly more in their favor and let them start climbing up that mountain, but instead let them say, that mountain, I'm going right over the top and I'm just going to, like, get you dead. That makes for exciting situations. So
I mean, there's two huge points that you just made. One is that feedback from your players is going to come in a certain form that's not going to cover a lot of what's important, or it's not going to actually reveal the underlying things that led to the way they felt. So you have to take into account, this is how you felt, that feedback is meaningful, but that doesn't necessarily come with a solution. The other thing you said that's super critical is that knowing what you're there for is really important, and that's why we always harp on understand what the goals for your cube are, which can be really difficult to understand. What does it even mean to make goals for my cube? But if you realize that you like those kinds of gameplay moments, make that a goal and focus on it.
I wonder if it would be helpful to newer cube designers to not ask what the goals for their cube are, because that so quickly ends up down the route of, like, balance and, you know, archetypes, and, you know, and that's all useful. But the question we really want to get at is, like, what are your goals for your playgroup? like, what are your goals for a cube night, right? Like, what do you want to happen there? And then let that inform the actual cube design decisions, because that's actually what you're in it for, right? You're in it to have a good time with your friends, so describe that good time and then work backwards.
Yeah. My good time involves tacos.
Good segue. I don't know if I have any tidy conclusions.
Good segue. Kick segue.
Well,
off
no, I feel like we need a conclusion to the prior segment. It's a good segue, and it could have been fine. We could have dithered the two segments of the show together
dithering.
Nicely. Anyway, I don't think I have a, like,
we
should tidy
talk about dithering more. Get that on our bingo card.
I don't think I have a tidy conclusion to this sort of mini topic on cheese and stealing games, other than to say that I think it's useful to be able to have the language to describe a class of cards that has this potential, because it is different to look at a board wipe and a threat and effect, or a Death Creator's Champion, or, and I think things with Flash and Haste kind of all fall into this category, right? Like, things that your opponent can't afford to or doesn't know to play around that then dramatically swing combat before they have a chance to untap and cast anything at sorcery speed. Those kinds of things, I think, are big here. To understand that those cards are in this space and they have this potential, and include the amount that you feel is appropriate for the kind of games you want, instead of just kind of recognizing them all as, like, cards that work when you're behind, instead of these clear distinctions.
Would you also put in this category, like, unexpected interaction? Like, I saw a weird game where people were very precise about the race and thought they had it, and then someone else had an instant speed life gain, which is not something you'd normally be excited about, but it was a similar effect where somebody attacked and then lost on the crackback. And also, I would wonder about just, like, individual cards that are so powerful, they just steal a game. I'm thinking about things like Ugin the Spirit Dragon, or Emrakul the Promised End, or, I mean, Mindslaver, these kinds of effects that literally just, like, this one card can do so much that if I have a bunch of mana, I can just end the game.
Let's save that for another episode, though, because I'm actually working on an article to this exact end right now. Well, not literally right now. Right now, I'm speaking to you on a podcast, but I'm drafting an article about exactly this topic, so that's a teaser for next time. And while we're waiting for that next time, let's enjoy some appetizers. It's not as good of a segue.
That's a much worse segue. Look, I fixed it. We got a request in the MTG Cube Talk Discord. People were like, you guys got to tell us more about your cooking process.
Let's be clear. Let's be clear.
Groups.
They were like, Anthony, you should tell us more about your cooking process. It's very generous of you
don't
to
put me on the spot like
it's
this.
It's very generous of you to lump me in here, but no one was like, Andy, how do you do it? Everyone was wanting to know how you did it,
well,
specifically.
I don't think that's fair, because I think that you are also a fantastic cook, and in a lot of ways are much more practical and pragmatic, and do a better job of the things that I would like to tell people to do.
I definitely have much lower expectations for myself if I'm hosting a meal than you do. I'm always like, Anthony, choose something that scales up easily, and you're like, what if I handmade pasta for everybody? And I'm like, that do not scale up that easily.
It does.
You're like, what
not.
About dumplings? I'm like, you have to make those by
scale.
Hand.
They
you have to make them by hand individually. They do not scale
but
up.
Earlier in the week.
Or you're like, I'm going to make all the pita fresh and warm, one pita at a time
it's
in my oven.
It. Oh, it's delicious.
I think I'm a better maybe a project manager for a big meal, but you are definitely the chief cook and okay, by far the best cook for this.
I think that is actually the valuable advice. So I do want to say, I don't know, should I say this? That like, I'm not a professional cook. If you want great cooking content, go somewhere else. But I know that you're a person that likes to play Magic the Gathering. Maybe you want to have a party where you host your friends and you cook for them.
Maybe you want to cook for, I don't know, say exactly eight people.
And yeah, we know something about that. So we thought we'd share a little bit about sort of our thoughts on how to host a group and cook for them easily and enjoy playing Magic with them. The first thing I just want to emphasize more than anything else is practice. Cooking takes practice, hosting takes practice, it all just takes practice. Like anything else you want to improve at, it's not going to be great and easy the first time, but hopefully you're hosting people for a fun cube night, and so they're going to come back regardless because they're going to have a fun time playing Magic.
Yeah, and eight people is a lot. For those of you that have not cooked for eight people, it is a substantial uptick from cooking for two or three people. It's not simply just do the same thing but a little bigger.
Yeah, and it gets so much easier. And I think that this is like, I think we have a weird set of cultural expectations around cooking that have been happening, especially with things like Instagram and a lot of, you know, people that have come up like writing their cookbooks in this context of everything is fast and easy and looks fabulous and beautiful, where, you know, people have these cookbooks of 15-minute recipes and people will feel kind of bummed out if they can't do that. And I think that what's being obfuscated there is just that these things really do take a lot of practice. And what is a 15-minute recipe when you are totally familiar with where everything in your kitchen is and you don't have to reference the recipe three times is not going to be a 15-minute recipe when you're first starting out. So just be kind to yourself, leave yourself plenty of time, and understand that it will become a lot easier every time you do it.
Yeah, I like those tips.
All right, next thing that is really critical is prep ahead. You don't want to be doing a whole bunch of cooking right before you're actually hosting. Again, especially like doing it the first time is going to be a lot harder once you know exactly how long it takes to, you know, do a certain setup, get things on the plates. You can definitely do a lot more at the moment later on, but especially starting out, just do as much as you can ahead of time. So, I mean, that could just be as much as like chopping and prepping the vegetables, having everything ready to go so you can actually throw things in the grill right at the last minute. Or it can mean literally doing everything in advance so you have it just like warm in the oven hours ahead of time.
We call that lasagna approach.
Exactly, which is an excellent, excellent approach. And if you are going to do like something a little bit, you want something that is a little bit fresher, a little bit comes right out of the oven and is hot, it's great to do like one thing at the minute.
One thing that is going to demand your actual attention that is time sensitive, that you want to be served hot. Uh-huh. Because, yeah, multiple things. Complexity scales exponentially as you add more things that need to happen simultaneously.
Yeah, I made this mistake just this weekend for your birthday where I was like, I'll make steaks and fried chicken. I can do both of these pretty easily, but doing both at the same time is difficult, even when you have excellent help in the kitchen.
Yeah, I've been very lucky to get to go to some really nice restaurants because my father-in-law is a big restaurant guy. And something you notice when you go to really nice restaurants is that the number of people in the kitchen to the number of guests just skews more and more and more and more to the kitchen and less to the guests as you get to fancier places. And yeah, there are some restaurants that are definitely like big profit centers with big margins and they're kind of ripoff or whatever. But there's also a lot of nice restaurants that are just, no one's getting rich off of it, but it actually takes a lot of human labor to make the kind of food they're making for you. And when you have multiple dishes coming out for a table that are all have different components all at the same time, like you might have a team of six cooks working on like essentially one table, more or less.
Especially if you're in a context where you're trying to do a lot of, you know, nice presentation where it takes a lot of putting things on the plate, that just takes so much labor. And, you know, the other side of that is the lasagna approach, which is an excellent, excellent approach. So, I mean, related to that, just like reduce plating and assembly. If you want to cook for a group of people, having things that are coming out of a big casserole dish, coming out of one big serving bowl, really saves you a lot of time so you're not trying to put things on individual plates and, you know, put sauces and garnishes and things like that. Just make it easy on yourself. And all
it
this
also
is
really
to
reduces food waste to let people plate for themselves.
That's
and
a great
select their own exact serving sizes and whether they want every component of the meal. If you plate things, you never know what person doesn't like asparagus or whatever.
Absolutely. And that ties into my next point, which is in a lot of groups, you're going to probably have different dietary restrictions or just preferences. People are going to be wanting different things or needing different things. Obviously, make sure you ask your guests what their preferences and needs are beforehand. Make sure you understand that. And doing that sort of plate yourself so everything can be separate and people can avoid what is not going to appeal to them is a great way to make that work.
I'd actually be really curious to hear our listeners overall impressions of their group's dietary restrictions. I've told you this anecdote, but I'll share it again on the podcast where I have not shared it, I don't think. We live in a city, a major city, and all of our friends are city-dwelling people, which I think there's a lot of, like, you know, political and social ramifications that come with living in a city like Baltimore. And part of that is that we have tons of friends with dietary restrictions. Like, some of them are medical, some of them are just lifestyle choices, but if we have 12 people over, there are four or five different sets of dietary restrictions to be navigated. I was cooking a big chili, doing the lasagna doing the lasagna approach to bringing some food to my sister and brother-in-law's combined bachelorette party. And there were like 35 people at this thing. And so I asked my sister, I was like, I need the dietary restrictions of all these people so I know what I can and can't put in the chili and what I have to label if I have to make multiple batches or whatever. And across 35 people of a very different population, namely my sister lives in the suburbs, not in a major city, and therefore has friends that also live in the suburbs and have made choices to live there. Zero. Zero dietary restrictions among 35 people. And I was like, that's absolutely unbelievable to me.
Very different from my experience.
Yeah. And so I wonder if we have listeners that are like, what do you mean dietary restrictions? I have 30 people over to my house every week and there's never been a dietary restriction. Or maybe you're like us and yeah, we have a complicated array of dietary restrictions to navigate. It's like playing Battleship a little bit.
A little bit. Or yeah, Tetris. What's the best game I was... To joke about this.
Not Jenga. You said Jenga. It's not Jenga. It's really not like Jenga at all.
Dietary restriction puzzle game. Insert puzzle game here.
What's the game called where you got all the cars and you're trying to get one car out? Is it called Rush Hour?
Yeah. Anyway, so yeah, I mean, accommodating dietary restrictions, honestly, is also kind of interesting. We often like to talk about how constraints breed creativity, and there are a lot of things that I have learned how to cook because I couldn't cook the thing that I was comfortable with, and now it's something else in my repertoire. Mm-hmm. So that is kind of cool. On the other hand, if you're a person that has a huge group of friends and zero dietary restrictions, that's a cool spot to be in as well. That comes with certain advantages and flexibility. Something else I'll say about this is it can be pretty frustrating. I think an easy way to look at meals and menus and recipes is to start with something you're familiar with and then figure out, oh no, this doesn't work, this doesn't work, and start cutting things out and start trying to figure out substitutions or
whatever.
Never
do substitutions.
That's honestly just not a fun way to go about cooking for me. I think it's much more effective to just look within the bounds of whatever restrictions you're working on and find what works there. And like, just think, okay, here's the ingredients available to me. What are the exciting things I could make if I was on a cooking game show, and I had this pile of ingredients on the table in front of me?
Iron Chef, the Bun Magic Kitchen Table Pro Tour's array of dietary restrictions.
Oh my God, that's great. Come check out that when that happens. And that can just be a much more, especially if you have really limiting restrictions, a much, much more fun way to approach it, I think. The last big thing to think about is just scaling. Some things are going to scale easily, some things are not. If you're making a lasagna, if you're making a chili, you get a bigger pot, you get more ingredients, you put it in, it's kind of the same thing. If you're trying to do a stir fry, that doesn't work so well because scaling it up actually changes the dynamics of the way it's cooking, so that's not going to work so well. I mean, same for deep frying, potentially, if you're in a home kitchen, that's not going to scale up well. So if you're looking at, you know, the list of things that you're comfortable cooking for 2 to 4 people, be aware that some things are just not going to scale up the same way, and focus on those braises, those grilled things, the things that come in one pot that are going to be easy to scale up.
Though, funnily enough, when I made that aforementioned big chili for that bachelorette party, it was the biggest batch of chili I've ever made. I forget exactly how much, but I think I had like 8 pounds of beef in it, 8 pounds of short ribs, and then like a bunch of everything else. And I so underestimated the amount of time it would take me just to brown the short ribs and then debone them.
That is true.
The whole thing took me, like, I remember I was up cooking until like 2 a.m. that night because I was so badly overestimated. I was like, oh, this is just the same thing. I make chili pretty regularly. I know it takes me this amount of time. And it took like 4 times as long to make 4 times the batch because there was actually way more labor that did not scale up in a way that I thought.
That's actually a great point. Yeah, think about not just scaling the ingredients, but how the labor scales. Because even like chopping an onion is very different from chopping 4 onions.
That's actually kind of the same. It's just 4 times as much.
But I think it's easy to underestimate that. You know, if you add,
I like the idea. There's a whole different technique for chopping 4 onions. It's totally different.
Yeah, it involves a big frying pan and you just squish it. Mm-hmm. Get your industrial size slap chop. The other thing that I think is worth considering when you're planning out a menu is just actually consider what you want to be doing during this event. If you want to be doing a lot of last minute prep, if you want to be in the kitchen, that is what brings you joy. That's great, but you might not want to be doing that. So that's just another great reason to think about how you want to do the prep ahead and think about what prep actually has to happen at the last minute. And is that something you're willing to do and will contribute to you having a fun experience hosting? I think we can't talk about the subject without bringing up Joe Anderson. The way that he cooks for his cube nights is kind of insane to me, but he'll be making his draft picks and walking back and forth between the kitchen and knowing, like, there's going to be a stack of five picks. We're not zone drafting because I got to go cook the tacos, and then I'm going to make those five picks really fast and go back and start heating up tortillas or whatever. If that is the experience you're looking for, that's great. But consider what a fun night looks for you and how you balance the prep ahead and last minute prep to make that experience happen.
Yeah, and I would add, do less better than more not as good.
Okay, say that with better words.
I thought that was perfect, frankly. Do a less complicated meal and give yourself the time and resources to do the simple thing better rather than if you're... I mean, I think a lot of times, like, if you're hosting a cube, you want to impress people, right? Like, you're trying to make a nice meal. You're trying to make the night fun for everybody so that they remember it fondly and come back and draft a cube again. And I think a lot of people will kind of overreach in that situation and try and do like one too many things or like a more complicated dish than they should or like two extra sides than they need to. And my advice would be to, especially if you haven't done this a whole bunch, set your goals lower and just accept that, yeah, doing a really nice lasagna is totally sufficient. You don't have to also do multiple different side dishes or make your own homemade focaccia. You're a bad person to give this advice because this is exactly what you do. You do the over-the-top, you know, great thing, which I'm extremely grateful for. But
I almost always have one thing that I drop last minute. I'm like, that side dish, we're just cutting it.
Well, I mean, I can never tell because there's Perfect. Already so many side dishes.
That reminds me of when we had Sam Black on, and he said something very poignant, which is that
better at magic than you.
Well, that he just really likes to impress people and like demonstrate his cleverness, and I think that is a very honest thing to say.
More people should be honest about that. Yes,
when you're hosting, you want to have people have a good time, but you also want to be impressing people with your hosting. So I think be honest to yourself about that and think about how to make it work without overdoing it and overexerting yourself. Another big thing to think about is just what actual social experience you're looking for. Is this really about you're hosting your magic night and then food is this separate thing? Or do you want it to be kind of simultaneous with the activity? Do you want people to be having their tacos and their pizza while they're in the middle of their games? Do you want everybody to be sitting down at a meal and eating at the same time? Or are you okay with people just grabbing stuff and snacking from the buffet? And also, do you want like other people helping you? Do you want to conscript people to get in the kitchen with you and help you get things ready? Or do you want to just have everybody sit down and have everything ready to go? And when you're planning out what you're prepping ahead and what you're doing at the last minute, factor all of that kind of what experience you're looking for into it. And like we always talk about with magic, make sure the expectations are communicated to your players or your guests as well.
And finally, if you don't enjoy cooking,
don't do it.
Hey, first of all, you don't have to do this, right? Like, you can, I don't think you need us to give you permission, but you can definitely just order pizza for Cube Night if you want. But, you know, maybe that's cost prohibitive or, you know, you don't enjoy cooking, but it's still something you want to do for your playgroup. Choose something easy, right? Yeah. Like, there are a lot of easy things out there that are going to be just as tasty and fill people up with just as many essential calories for cube drafting as anything more complicated. I would say, like, don't put yourself in a position where you're not having fun and it's not sustainable for you.
For sure.
Because even if you make everyone else have a great night, if you were just stressed out and unhappy the whole time, you're not going to do it again.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, pizza's great. Nobody's going to complain about pizza. So I do want to give a couple concrete examples now. So we talked about it's great to be able to do some prep ahead of time, have things be composable and self-servable so that you can more easily accommodate dietary restrictions and preferences. I think one of the easiest things, and I asked around in a couple places and got the same first answer every single time, was tacos.
Tacos.
It's great. It's like already gluten-free, which in our play group hits a couple people or doesn't.
If
you're using corn tortillas, thank you. That's an important clarification. You can have a bunch of different options for fillings, which is super flexible. You can make a lot of these things ahead of time, so you can just have it warm in the oven or whatever, and then there's also a lot of flexibility. Let's go on the other end.
It helps that taco is very flexibly defined. Like,
that's also
pretty
true.
Much anything in a corn tortilla, you can call it a taco. Yeah. So, you know.
But if you do want to show off, there's flexibility there too, where you can make a bunch of different salsas, you can make a bunch of different vegetable toppings, a lot of garnishes, things like that. And it's one of the easiest dishes you can make. I think in a similar vein, doing like mezze or Italian antipasti, something like that, where you have, again, just a bunch of little dishes that people can compose themselves. So it's like maybe there's some cured meats for people who are interested in that, but you also have a couple different vegetable dishes. I really like doing some like cold roasted eggplant is a great thing. And if you want to, I don't know, make your own breads and things like that. But you can also just go to the store.
You're not a great person to recommend this because here are the easy things. Tacos.
Okay.
Lasagna.
Lasagna. I'll write that down.
Chili. Big spaghetti night.
Big spaghetti.
Look at things they do at churches when they have like
a... spaghetti yourself.
Look at... No, don't do this. Look at the kinds of things they serve at churches when they are having like, you know, a dinner at the church or whatever. That's the kind of things that are actually easy and scale up and work really nicely. If the weather's nice, it's very easy to just have a grill night, essentially, right?
Yep,
if you have
a
grill outdoors. Because that also is only defined by the fact that it goes on the grill, right? So you can basically have anything you want. You can have mushroom caps for people that are vegan and all kinds of substitute versions of sausages and patties and stuff that are also vegetarian or whatever.
Kebabs are a great option in that vein where you can do like basically all the prep ahead and have, again, like in the same structure, here's all my vegetable dishes, here's some proteins, and then the one thing you're doing is putting things in the grill, and then maybe there's some cold sides, and everything just comes out with that one action of putting kebabs on the grill. This is something I'm not really familiar with, but I feel like Indian food, which...
Curries are good, yeah.
I don't want to pigeon Indian food into one thing because it is a tremendous diverse world of many different cuisines, but if you're an American, you know what I'm talking about.
Just Indian
curries and rice is... I mean, this food was designed for... This cuisine was designed for cooking for huge crowds and it being super easy to set up last minute. So, yeah.
And also being done ahead of time.
And being done
ahead
of time,
so much of those recipes actually come from the fact that there's a longstanding practice of, like, essentially packing a warm lunch in a, like...
Absolutely.
There's a whole culture of that. So it's meant to be a thing that like that keeps well and you can reheat and, you know, all the kind of stuff.
So yeah, I mean, I think those are some of the great ones. I mean, we could also throw in like there's a lot
of great
things.
Some of the great meals to host for the Cube Group.
If you reach for Chinese cuisine, I'm a huge fan of doing Sichuan where you can do like a huge batch of Mapo Tofu is similar to a curry. It's like a big braised thing and it stays warm and then is easy to serve as well as... Again, getting into like stir fries and stuff is difficult, but there are a lot of delicious sort of braised dishes that you can explore in that cuisine as well. If you want to go crazy like me, I really like making ramen for a crowd because it does impress people and it's like one of my favorite dishes to eat. And if you want to have everybody sitting down with a composed dish, I think that's a lot of fun. It's easy to get other people involved in like plating and stuff like that. I do really like dumplings. It is a lot of work, but it's all work you can do ahead of time and then throw them in the freezer. So then you're just boiling or steaming them last minute, which is really easy.
So if it's work you enjoy and, you know, making dumplings is the thing you want to try to do or you want to do more, that's a great thing to make for your play group.
Something else that I think is fun that I want to do is hot pot, where this would be a little bit more extreme to the like making the meal an activity in addition to other activities. But that's a fun thing where you can even have people bring ingredients or you can, again, do all the prep ahead of time. So all you're doing last minute is just taking out a bunch of sliced prepared vegetables and meats and putting the hot pot on the table.
And then we hop out while we're drafting, right? And then everyone's finished eating their meal
really
by the time the draft
sticky,
is over.
Sticky draft. I would like to do this at some point. Something else to consider there is just like how much are your guests comfortable sharing food together and things like that. So definitely cater your menu so everyone is comfortable in that respect. But hot pot is something I would like to try.
I'm down.
I have some other things written down, but I think that's
good. We covered a lot.
We should stick with tacos and spaghetti, huh? And grilled stuff.
Yeah, that's the easiest stuff. If ease is the main limiting factor, then I think that's what you should be looking to. If you are ambitious and you want to take on a little more, then all the tips you gave, I think, are really helpful to actually plan a more complicated meal for people. And it bears repeating, feeding your drafters is one of the best ways to actually get eight people in a room. Eight and only eight, which I know is the platonic ideal for so many cube drafters. I would encourage you to have flexibility so you can draft with fewer or more people so that you don't have to have such pressure on getting exactly the right number of people in the room. But if you do want to try and make that happen, then the best way is the promise of food, and food before the draft, because otherwise everyone would just be late.
Yeah, that's a great point. So, yeah, I mean, I've really enjoyed doing more hosting the last couple of years, and I feel like I've become a much better cook. And I feel like, in a way that I don't feel like I'm becoming a better Magic player for the amount of Magic I want to play, I am definitely becoming a better cook for the amount of cooking I'm doing, and that's really satisfying and rewarding. So if it is vaguely interesting to you and you're just intimidated by it, your play group is probably great guinea pigs for you to practice on.
Yeah, I think it's easier to learn how to cook than it is to learn how to play Magic.
Yeah. Think about that, listener.
We had a great... I'm going to forget the username now. I apologize, person whose username I'm not going to be able to remember. But somebody recommended this book, Range, based on our podcast episode a few back, all about me trying to get better at Magic and the sort of tensions and challenges involved there. And there's a dichotomy described in that book between kind and wicked learning environments. Kind learning environments are basically ones where you have direct feedback on your practice and you can implement a change and then see how that actually plays out. And essentially, like, you know, they're environments without variance, right? Like cooking, if you are trying a new technique, you can try it and see how it tastes. And if it comes out good, then you learn something. If it comes out bad, you learn something. But it's all very, like, direct and straightforward. Magic is a wicked learning environment in that you can't look at your results and you can't be results-oriented, right? Like, the whole results-oriented thinking thing from limited resources. If you can be results-oriented about something you're learning, then it's a much kinder learning environment with a much tighter feedback loop and a much easier way to know how to improve. And in Magic, like, how do you know if you mulliganed correctly? You literally don't. You never know.
Yeah. Thank you to Violtech. How do you pronounce this?
Vialtaic?
They recommended the book.
Spell it.
V-I-O-L-A-T-I-C.
Violatic?
Yeah, it's confusing.
I always pronounce it Voltaic in my head, but that's not how it's spelled.
It's not how it's spelled. Yeah. That's what I was going to do.
I think there's a lot of usernames that I shortcut to a more pronounceable, similar word that is not actually the word that is being presented to me.
You're cutting all this out, right?
No, definitely not. Thanks to Viatalic. Voltaic, thank you V for the recommendation of the book. I did just pick it up from my local bookstore. I had to order it, but they got it in. I picked it up yesterday, so I plan on reading it. Maybe we'll report back on the podcast.
Nice.
All right, that's it for this episode of Lucky Paper Radio. Thank you for tuning in for our episode about cheese, both magic cheese and lasagna cheese. How's that for a title? Magic cheese and lasagna cheese.
What about magic cheese and taco cheese?
Yeah, there we go. That's better. Yeah. All right. That's the title.
Okay.
Nice job. All of our music is produced by DJ James Nasty. All the magic cards are produced by Wizards of the Coast. The show is produced by me thinking really hard about magic cards and Anthony thinking really hard about cooking. And then us both speaking into microphones about it.
I'm hungry now.
Yeah, I'm hungry too. I wonder what I'm having for dinner.